Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and its sequels have sold over 60 million copies worldwide and spawned several hit films. But Mr. Larsson died suddenly in 2004, just a few months before they were published, so he never got to see his books in print. Now his life partner, Eva Gabrielsson, has written a memoir of their 30 years together and the very public legal battle over his literary estate. She's called it There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me, and it's written with Marie-Françoise Colombani. Seven Stories Press is the publisher, and I'm very pleased it has brought Eva Gabrielsson to our show today. Hello.
Hello there.
You're an architect by profession, and although you've written other books, this one has become something of a media event. Was it difficult to do?
Well, really difficult to write, I think. I had to go not only through the process of reliving what happened after Stieg died, but mainly going through parts of the life we had so I could give something back to the Millennium readers. But I wanted to do it, and it was mainly done for myself. So,
but you did get the help of Marie-Françoise Colombani.
Yeah, she edited the manuscript, cut down everything she thought was not necessary or incomprehensible and so on, and asked me to expand on things that I just passed by. So, yeah, she was a great help.
Well, we all need editors.
Exactly.
But you do come out of journalism to some degree, don't you?
Not really, no, but I mean,
that was just Stieg?
Yeah.
Is this the first time that you've come to this country to talk about him and the books?
No, it's the first time in the United States ever. So.
Ever?
Yeah.
Well, he didn't live long enough to go on a book tour for the series. Would he have done something in Sweden under normal circumstances?
Absolutely. I think he would have really liked to, maybe not be in media that much, but getting a chance to talk to the readers. And that is what he would have appreciated worldwide.
Well, you are his stand-in, in effect, here.
Oh.
I hope he's proud of what you're doing. When and where did you meet?
We met in 1972 when we were 18 years old at a meeting dealing with the Vietnam War, and we were later also activists to try to stop that war.
So it was an anti-war. This is the way so many people met in this country, but I didn't know it was something that happened in Sweden as well.
It did, and it was a huge movement. We had a lot of the American deserters in Sweden, and so you got their stories, and you could see what had happened to them as persons, and they were sort of broken down, actually. And you didn't want that to go on for anybody. So,
was political activism something that you shared throughout your life together?
Yeah. Stieg's speciality, though, became extreme right-wing in both in Sweden and United States, and, well, Europe, so that became his speciality. But the idea behind being a political activist is to sort of set the world right and create justice for those who are, well, done wrong to. So that was the main theme, mainly a humanistic approach rather than a political approach.
So he was opposed to the move to the right. I've never thought of Sweden as a country that was particularly right-wing.
I don't think we are either, but globally politics have moved to become sort of a middle thing where you don't see really left or right or anything, and that's where Sweden is as well.
On a less political note, weren't you also raised by your grandparents, both of you, in the north of Sweden?
Yeah.
Did that create some kind of a bond between you?
I try to describe that in my book because that's something I actually found out when I was writing this, looking back into our lives, that to my surprise I saw that the background in the north of Sweden, in this harsh climate, this tough country, you have to be a survivor, and you can't be a survivor being a lone hero. You have to rely on others for cooperation and help and so on. And that was a common factor between Stieg and me, and something that I really think kept us together for all these times.
Is this something you talked about a lot?
Not really. It was just there, but putting it down on paper was a revelation to me personally.
My guest is Eva Gabrielsson. Her book, There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me, is published by Seven Stories Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you met at 17. When did you start living together?
We started living together in 2 years later on. We were living with other people then. We rented big apartments or big houses because that was what was available.
But from, kind of like a commune?
Yeah, but mainly because out of necessity to get somewhere to live at all. But we moved together on, in our own place in 1977 or 78 when I moved to Stockholm and Stig moved with me. So we lived together since then.
Did you ever consider getting married?
Oh, we did. We actually bought the rings. Mm-hmm. I have them on me now, and it's they say Stig and Eva, but activism came in the way, and shortly after, we planned to marry in 1983, but things came in the way, and later on it became impossible during the 1980s, just a few years later on, because Stig had started to write about the extreme right wing in the British magazine Searchlight. So people were looking for him all over Europe. Who is this new?
So it was felt that it was too dangerous for the both of you?
Well, yeah, mainly for him, but they could get to him through me, so it was best if I sort of was his front in all respects.
But as I understand it, the majority of couples in Sweden are not married these days, and we're seeing a growing trend all over the world in this country as well.
Mm. Yeah, it's a global trend, and that's what people do. They stay together for years and years and years without getting married, and we are considered also as being equal to married while we are alive. And suddenly when someone dies, you found out that you had been considered being two singles all your life. And yeah.
And then it's only when you have to deal with the law that it becomes a real issue. I gather the title, There Are Things I Want You to Know, it comes from a letter he wrote to you when he was just 22?
Mm, yeah.
What did he want you to know that you didn't know? You'd been together at that time for 5 years.
Yeah. Well, I think he wanted me to know that he wasn't afraid of dying, that he, being an amateur astronomer, had realized his, well, unimportance in the universe and accepted his fate happily. And he also wanted me to know that he loved me very, very much. And that he would sort of miss me when he was gone. But he also gave me very generously, because I've been reading that letter over and over again after he passed away, giving me the strength to go on. Because he says in the letter that you have to pick yourself up. You have to walk out in the world today. You have to go out and take your coffee at the normal coffee shop. And you must live and love again and realize who you are.
And you worked it out, you going into architecture and he going into journalism?
Yeah.
Many people have assumed that Stig modeled Michael Blomqvist on himself. In reality, how close was he to the character?
Not as a person, I would say. Not that many similarities, but the similarities are in their views on journalism and on media. This definite belief that media are there for the people, media are there to reveal things, but also to explain things, to keep any democratic society alert and moving. That means people have to be informed. And that's the common thing between Stig and Mikael Blomqvist, the idea of journalism as a tool for upholding a continuous development of society.
And there are also autobiographical details, aren't there? I mean, Millennium, the fictional magazine and the books, is obviously based on Expo, the magazine that Stig founded in 1995.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels to the real life and reality. So the majority of my book is about that, what was parts of our real life that was used in Millennium. And I just want to explain to the readers that they can rely on the things that are being said there, the values that are being said there about protecting people, fighting for justice and so on, because that was what was in our life. So that's also what I'm describing in my book.
But I suspect he didn't know anyone quite like Lisbeth Salander.
No.
Is she based on anybody?
She's actually based on a lot of people.
Some people say Pippi Longstocking.
Well, that was the sort of the original creative impulse. While he and his colleagues at the Swedish news agency were having coffee late one night and really tired, and started joking about what would happen if our childhood heroes grew up. So that was the creative impulse, but that was, I guess, 10 years before he even started writing Millennium.
Well, Pippi Longstocking as a kind of feminist superhero, a tattooed bisexual computer hacker who's able to win physical fights against bigger and stronger men.
Yeah.
So it also grows out of his feminist side, because so much of these books have to do with about the power struggle between men and women.
Yeah. The unnecessary power struggle, I'd say. It's maybe more of a power struggle per se than a struggle between men and women, but women sort of always end up being the ones who lose, so... Stig actually called himself a feminist when I met him, and he was 18 then. I was also 18, and that was kind of that was very unusual in those times. Women were okay to be feminists, but men were—that was kind of dubious. Could they be feminists?
But it's still argued about in this country. If a man says he's a feminist, some yeah. people say that's nice, and others will say it's impossible.
Hmm.
When did he begin writing the Millennium trilogy?
During our summer vacation in 2002.
Mm-hmm. Did he do it because he just wanted to make some money? Because as I know from personal experience, nonprofit journalism doesn't pay very well.
No, he did it because he was bored. I was sitting there trying to sum up a manuscript I was working on, and he had nothing to do. So he started to complain, what am I to do now that you are sitting here writing all the time? And started joking about a small text he had written in 1997 about an old man who receives flowers each year. And so I just asked, who is this man? I don't know, Stig said. Who's sending the flowers? I have no idea. Why is he receiving them each birthday? I don't know that either. Well, isn't that interesting to find out?
And that's what got him started?
That's when it started, just for fun and out of boredom. And so, you see, no big plan.
Although many guests have told me, former journalists who have turned to fiction, that they could tell more truth in fiction than they could in their journalism, and also reach a much wider audience.
Mm. Yeah, I quite agree with that. But as I'm saying, the starting point of big things can sometimes be boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the case.
So when did it take over? Because, I could see starting a novel or a short story out of boredom, but you wind up writing three-quarter books? We'll get into that final manuscript later.
Well, three books in, I'd say, 24 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did he try to sell the first book went to the other two?
Absolutely not. No. He continued. When the first one was sort of finished, he started the second one and also started on the third one, moving back and forth. And so, you see, it was just a labor of love. He was just having fun. It gradually occupied more and more of his free time. And I understand from the people at Expo that he also took quite some time off his ordinary working time to continue writing these books. And that's why there's not much research gone into the books either. They were people and places and events and so on were based on things that we'd done and seen and talked about in our life. And that's also what I put into my book, to explain that the reality basis of Millennium.
Do you think that he saw them as a single work?
Yeah. As a trilogy, that was something I had to explain to Swedish media when Stig died, because I was the one who could talk about these books that summer, and that's why I explained that you have to see them as a whole, these three, as a finished trilogy.
My guest is Eva Gabrielsson. Her book, There Are Things I Want to Know, I Want You to Know About Stig Larsson and Me. It is published by Seven Stories Press, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Eva Gabrielsson, an architect, author, and political activist. Currently, her architectural practice includes housing and office construction and heading a European Union initiative to create sustainable architecture in the Dalecarlia region. She has written a new memoir called There Are Things I Want You to Know About Stieg Larsson and Me. It's written with the help of Marie-Françoise Colombani and published by Seven Stories Press. You mentioned that he always considered himself a feminist. Was there a particular event that caused him to focus on the rights of women in writing these books?
I think he was brought up like that by his maternal grandfather and grandmother, because he was living with them until he was almost 9 years old. I think they had a special relationship, and also in a special circumstance, cultural and circumstance that I describe in the book, being harsh country, you need others to survive, and you can't really put women down, because then you'll die. You have to see them, treat them with respect, so... It comes basically from there, but the experiences later on in his life, I think, reinforced that, among other things, a rape he witnessed when he was 14.
Well, the Millennium Trilogy focuses on crimes like rape, domestic abuse, incest, murder, even sex trafficking, and as has been pointed out many times, the Swedish title of the first book translates as Men Who Hate Women, not The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You've said that he would never have allowed that title to be affixed to the translation, although that sure sold a lot of books, didn't it?
Yeah, well, he refused the Swedish publisher to change it. He had to fight to keep it in Sweden, and that means that he would fight to keep it anywhere else as well. So, and the books were actually called, the working title was Men Who Hate Women 1, 2, and 3. So the other two got their formal printed titles very much later on.
Well, there's a lot of graphic violence in the first novel especially, and some argue that it's a matter of having your cake and eating it, too.
I don't quite understand that. How do you mean?
Well, you know, you say I'm against this sort of thing, and at the same time you give people rather very graphic descriptions of it.
Yeah. Unfortunately...
It's like being against pornography, but showing pornography at the same time.
Yeah. I can understand that argument. Problem is, the graphic descriptions are taken from real police reports, and I think that is reality. There's another thing that I don't think that the victims in these books are really treated as victims as such or as objects to get the story going. Some crime novels do that. They need a body here and there to raise interest in the books. But Stieg treats the victims with respect. He explains who they were, what they were working with. He gives them some sort of dignity. And maybe that makes up or balances the graphic violence a bit.
You mentioned earlier that he drew upon your own experiences, just places you visited, events that occurred to you. And he also writes a lot about women. Did he talk about all of these things with you as he was working on the books?
Yeah. And also I read continuously when he wanted me to read or when I felt the interest to need what had happened in the next chapter and so on.
Did you ever say to him, Stieg, this is not working?
Yeah, I did.
No woman would ever say that?
Yeah, I did. And we, yeah. But now, that's the extent to what I interfered in the actual writing. Otherwise, I let him.
Because you do know that many people have suggested he wasn't a very good writer and that you must have played some role in the writing of these books. Some have also suggested that you were a collaborator.
Yeah. I don't understand those arguments. I sometimes guess that this is old-time envy that comes up, because Stieg was actually quite respected as a journalist and well-known internationally for his knowledge on the extreme right wing. You can look at his production there. It's part of his literary legacy. So of course, you don't interfere with somebody's writing when it's fiction, but I must admit I did interfere with the writing of other things he did, because he wanted me to. He wanted me to edit or add or change, so he had no problem with letting me handle his text, so to say. But this was special. This was a creative flow that you can't just step into with your big ideas and disturb it. So So I'd contributed with ideas. I contributed with discussions along the way. I contributed with saying yes and no, but offering very few suggestions on how to solve things. And I contributed with the ideas during the life we had together and the analysis I made and the things that only I knew that he didn't know. So he was a good craftsman in writing when he wrote fiction, but just being a good craftsman doesn't mean that you have the necessary ideas to make it interesting. So
this is not an unusual situation. People often talk about their ideas with somebody close to them, somebody they trust. Yeah. Can you tell us about the events of November 9th, 2004?
The day he died.
He was going to his office, and the elevator was out, so he climbed 7 flights of stairs, and then he had a massive heart attack.
Yeah.
He was 50 years old. Was there...
Just turned 50 at that, yeah.
Had there been any concern about his heart up until then?
Well, he didn't voice any concern. I was a bit concerned because he was starting to get a bit overweight. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, no problems with his heart, no problems of any kind. And he never complained, and I didn't see anything. So I left him Monday evening late. He was fine. I called him Monday night.
You were in another city doing something?
Yeah, I was temporarily working in another county, so I worked there four days a week and then 3 days in Stockholm back. And he was fine. And then suddenly on Tuesday, middle of the day after lunch, I get a phone call that he has collapsed. And I was asked to I just said, that's not possible. He was fine. Last night, 12 hours ago, he was fine. What do I do? Well, you better come immediately. So I took the first train to Stockholm, and when I arrived at about 9 o'clock in the evening, he had been dead. He died the moment I got on the train. It was spooky. You see the time afterwards. Yeah.
When you did the research, he died intestate. Why hadn't he ever made a will?
Well, we. Most people in Sweden don't do wills.
You say he understood that he was in more danger than many people. One of the reasons you didn't get married is that your address would have been published.
Yeah, but you write a will when you have something that's in the estate, and we didn't have anything. So there was really no... We didn't have any money, really. We owned an apartment together. That was our cash. We did get new money, or should have gotten new money, about 50,000 euro in advance for the first 3 books, and they were to be put into a company. But he died just 6 months after signing those contracts, so everything happened so fast.
Well, you live with him for 30 years. Doesn't Sweden make provisions for what we would call a domestic partnership in this country?
No, there's no such thing.
Which is weird in a country where the majority of couples are unmarried.
Yeah. Well, so you might think, but the official Sweden statistics, they rate people who live together of the opposite sex and don't have common children together. They are counted as singles. So if you move in with someone who has a child and you have a child, you're still counted as 2 singles in the statistics, so the statistics show a very low number of true cohabitants.
And that only changes if you have a child.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're the equivalent of being married.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that after Stieg died, people said, wait a minute, maybe we should change the laws.
Absolutely. My form book last year was about these cohabitant situation in Sweden in the hope of changing the law. But even before then, there were people in parliament who wanted to change it from different political camps, and they put forward proposals to at least add the thing in the current law that you could go to court. I can't even go to court.
Does this apply to gay people as well?
Yeah.
So who inherited Stieg's estate?
His father and brother.
But hadn't he not even lived with them when he was growing up?
No, he...
lived with his, you said, with his grandmother in the north.
Yeah, he was brought up by them, and then his grandfather died, and Stieg had to be moved away from there, because grandmother really, she was poor and sickly and couldn't take care of him, so he was then moved to his biological family further south. And so he lived with them until he was 17, then he moved away from
home. Had he been close to them as an adult?
No, I never saw that, unfortunately. But with the start of life like that, being somewhere else your first 9 years, it's difficult maybe to attach later on. I don't know.
Well, when he died, you say you owned very little. The apartment that you shared, maybe a small amount of money he'd gotten as an advance. So that was it?
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what Stieg's estate is worth now?
Last I heard was 50 million copies sold. Sometime someone said today 60 million. Well, if you count a euro per copy, it's...
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's close to $100 million then.
And that's all gone to his father and brother?
Yes.
By all accounts, they haven't changed their lifestyles much. So what are they doing with all the money?
I don't know. I really don't know.
And they must have offered to give you something.
Well, they offered me, what was it, something like... $3 million year before last as a sort of settlement sum.
Why do you think they're being so greedy?
I'm not sure if it's greed.
It's a way of punishing you, do you think?
I don't think it's a way of punishing me either. I think it's just my personal reflection. I've been wondering about this for years now. This came out of the blue, this way of reasoning. I think it's a way of punishing Stieg as well. Because he chose another life, and he chose it with me, and somehow...
And were they embarrassed by his politics?
No, I think they were envious of his success in that field as well. And if you have a second success, it's also... Because he was bragging about it in an email... That the letterbox looks like a slot machine now and so on, because it was obvious the books would be a success in Sweden, in Scandinavia, and in Germany. And that's full stop there, not anymore. And he was happy about that and bragging about that.
So it was already being projected as a big bestseller.
So I think that raised a lot of envy.
So this must have gone to the courts, no?
No, I can't go to court, I just told you.
Because you don't have any legal standing.
Yeah, I was single for all these years, and Stieg was also single for all these years. So that means the estate goes to the blood relatives.
Had he appointed a literary executor, as many writers do?
No, he was too busy finishing the third book to give that to the editor and start editing the first one with the editor because it had to be published. So. Plus his full-time job, plus doing a little here and there on the beginning of the fourth book just to keep the ideas rolling.
So there was no discussion about control over the unpublished writings and the characters that he'd created?
No, we planned to live, not to die. So we were planning forward what to do with our life and the 3 to 4 million Swedish kronas we expected.
You said that he always saw this as a trilogy. Did he have any more planned? A series of 10 like Martin Beck, the Martin Beck series by Mai Sjöwall or and Per Wallu?
Yeah, he was planning to write 7 more. So it would be 10 in total in the Millennium series. But there was no plans as such for what the intrigues would be or the characters. Exactly, he would keep the main characters, Blomqvist and Salander, of course, but...
What about the fourth novel that there are rumors about that was in his laptop?
Well, it's a fragment of a book, as far as I understand. I've estimated it to 200 pages, given what I knew it was at the end of August on the last vacation we had. And he died 2 months later on.
And his father and brother control that as well, by law?
I don't know. That's an interesting legal question. I don't know.
Now, the books have already been made into films in Sweden, and then there are American versions in the works. Have you been consulted on any of them?
No.
Were you happy with the way the ones that have been made have turned out?
I was extremely happy with Noomi Rapace. I think she did a great interpretation of Lisbeth Salander. From what I understand, she also had to fight to make the character the way she wanted to, and I think she... She really went into the books and managed the literary legacy on her own on that.
Yeah, she was on the show to talk about being in the film, and it was obviously very important to her. Where's the laptop now?
I can't answer that question.
In Sweden, you have many supporters. Some of them have set up a website called www.supporteva.com to raise money for your legal expenses.
Actually, they are Norwegians. They are all Norwegians, and it was set up in Norway, which is also culturally interesting.
Eva Gabrielsen will be reading and signing books tonight at Union Square Barnes & Noble store at 7 o'clock, and then on Thursday she'll be speaking with Gloria Steinem at the 92nd Street Y at 8:15. Ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much.